Support for Culture Q comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Hello and welcome to Culture Q, the art show that rocks. I'm your host, Ryan Wilson. This week, we look at how different cultures in the Twin Cities celebrate Easter, how to pick the perfect wine for your next family dinner, and learn about resources for independent filmmakers in Minnesota. Tickets are free, and there's no wait, as we explore what's going down in the Twin Cities this week on Culture Q. How do Christians honor their Savior's rise from the dead? Hiding hard-boiled eggs, of course. Easter is tomorrow, and while the coloring of eggs doesn't seem to have much to do with Jesus, it's still a very important cultural tradition for some. This week, Sophia Anasizieski found out what it means to Minnesota's Ukrainian community.
So when the egg is white, you cover with wax what you want to remain white. Then you put the egg in a yellow dye bath, you cover with wax what you want to remain yellow, and the wax resists the other dyes. You go to orange, red, blue, and so on to the darkest color, and when the egg is darkest, you melt the wax off and the design is revealed underneath.
That was Natalia Lisi-Reland, the head of ODUM, a local Ukrainian youth association. Natalia is a part of the thriving Ukrainian community in Minneapolis. She and her family have been making Ukrainian Easter eggs for generations. Every year at Easter, ODUM sends its members to every Byerly store in Minnesota to sell eggs and demonstrate the craft.
So we learned how to make the eggs when we were very small, and now I've taught my children how to make the eggs. They're teenagers now. And in our family tradition, in the Byerly stores, we've had four generations making and selling the eggs, to include my grandmother, my mother, myself, and my children.
After the Second World War, many Ukrainian refugees immigrated to the United States rather than return home to Ukraine, which was under Soviet rule. They feared religious and ethnic persecution. Here, they established community organizations, dance groups, churches, restaurants, and bands. Kramarchuk Sausage Company, a Twin Cities institution, was founded by Ukrainian immigrants and is still run by their son, Orest Kramarchuk. Here, Orest talks about his father's troubles with his business partner.
He ended up running after my father with a butcher knife, so my father decided that he was going to break up the partnership. Well, he broke up the partnership, but the man ran off with all their money. So then my father, distraught and having lost everything that he owned, wandered East Hennepin Avenue and came upon an old German who owned a store called Central Provision. And so my father convinced him to buy the business, and I actually have the actual receipt that he used when he bought the business for $714, and that was in 1954.
For many Ukrainians, passing tradition to their children is an essential part of raising them. For Orest Kramarchuk, this tradition takes the form of butter lambs. Every Easter, Ukrainians go to church to bless Easter food in baskets. One component of these baskets is butter.
My grandmother made these little butter lambs for the baskets, and then when she was alive, she actually made them for me, and then I passed on tradition to my children, who have actually made them as well.
Kramarchuk also hosts local ethnic music groups. This is the Ukrainian Village Band, just one more piece of Ukrainian heritage in Minnesota. Like Orest Kramarchuk and Natalia Lisi-Reland, the founder of the band, Stefani Vaskevich, grew up as an active member of the Ukrainian community.
We were very involved. I was baptized in the Ukrainian Catholic Church, attending events at the Ukrainian Community Center. I was part of a youth organization called SUM, which means Ukrainian Youth Association. Every Friday, went there. For dancing and for classes about Ukrainian culture. We did arts and crafts, we made Easter eggs, we learned about our heritage. But it was a little bit more than just learning about your heritage, you know, it was a living thing because we had our grandparents around us all the time. It was everything we did.
Like many others growing up in the Ukrainian community, Stefan Ivaskevich has maintained his heritage through adulthood.
I couldn't possibly not be involved with things Ukrainian unless I really wanted to go against everything I was raised being.
For Culture Q, this is Sofia Anastasievsky.
If you're getting together with your family this weekend, whether for Easter, Passover, or secular reasons, alcohol certainly helps. Chugging a six-pack or downing a liter of Jim Beam may be frowned upon at your family's dinner table, but there's no classier way to get drunk than wine. Sarah Bowden learned the finer points of this spirit at a local wine shop.
The world of wine can be scary and expensive. There are so many different types of wine. You could go to a wine tasting, but again, those can be expensive. Solution? Enter Certix, Hennepin Avenue's wine and spirit shop, and owner Jim Certix, whose grandfather started the business back in 1934.
So we're walking through Certix. We have a big ice cooler. That's important.
Yes, always keep everything cold.
Well, not everything, Mr. Certix. Wine, for example, should not be kept cold. Chilled, maybe, but not cold. First things first, though.
Let's go taste some wine.
Would you like to see my ID?
I'd love to see your ID before you start tasting.
Every Friday and Saturday, Certix has a free wine tasting. People can come and figure out the exact right Merlot or Cabernet free of charge, which is a pretty good deal if you're a college student or cheap. Trained wine pourer Mandy Scopeland helps me figure out what I like.
Well, I like dry red wines in general. Do you like Italian reds?
I have no idea.
Well, let's find out. We have a great Barbera right here. It's gonna be medium body, nice and earthy. Let's see what you think.
The Barbera is way too tart for my palate. Wine connoisseurs use lots of adjectives like full-bodied and earthy, but these words can just seem confusing to someone who's new to wine. Kate Chaney used to work at Certix as a college student, but now is in advertising. She came in to buy an amaretto, but stops by the booth for some free samples. Chaney helps me understand the nuances of wine. She recommends focusing on what the scents remind you of, like your grandma's apple jam, or Spain in the springtime, or...
It smells sort of like a co-op. It smells sort of like organic something, like fruits or vegetables, like the produce section. It doesn't, but it smells very fresh too, but it's sort of a little bit spicy or smoky.
It does smell like a co-op. I totally get that. Now that you mention it.
Isn't that funny? That's all it is. When people are describing wine, and they use all these different words, they're just, it's what it reminds them of. There are no rules, and it would be completely different for everybody. And that's what's so fun about it.
Scopeland echoes the sentiment that there are no steadfast rules when it comes to wine.
You know what you like, and that's what you like. It's totally fine. Don't let any wine snob tell you that that's not the right thing to be drinking with that meal or whatever. It's your own preference, and that's the great thing about wine is you don't have to know it all. All you have to know is what you like.
While there are no rules, I do pick up some pointers at Certix, like how to not get intoxicated when you are sampling a lot of wine.
What's the spit after?
You're supposed to spit?
Yes, so when you're tasting, you just swish around your mouth, and then we have a little spit bucket over here that you can spit and taste more wine that way.
Oh, I thought that was a crock pot.
There isn't any crock pot. No, it's a spit.
Yeah.
Platoon.
A platoon?
Yes, platoon.
A spittoon.
According to Certix, the French use spittoons all the time. And if the French do it. For Culture Q, I'm Sarah Bowden.
This is Culture Q. I'm Ryan Wilson. It's time for the Top 7, brought to you this week by Christetta Borini.
Hey there, Radio K listeners. This is Christetta Borini, and I'm here with Danica Miller, speech, language, and hearing sciences major and a psychology major.
Hello, everyone.
And today we're bringing you your top 7 ridiculous words in the English language. So, Danica, how about you start us off with number 7?
Well, after much debate, we have come to the conclusion that the number 7 ridiculous word in the English language is uvula.
Ah, yes, the uvula. Now, I forget, what is that again?
Well, it turns out that the uvula is the dangly thing at the back of your throat that, when you yodel, swings back and forth.
Oh, right. I always see that in cartoons. How about number 6? Give us number 6.
Well, following up from uvula, we have brouhaha. Yes, it's a lovely word. It's fairly onomatopoeic. I mean, you get to say ha-ha, and you are doing, haberdashery, things like that. Brouhaha.
Brouhaha, of course. Brouhaha. Of course. And number 5, please.
For number 5, we have gubernatorial.
Ah, yes. Perfect for the upcoming gubernatorial election.
Yes, for anything having to do with governors, you have the word gubernatorial to add to your adjective list. It's very interesting because instead of gubernatorial, it's a goober.
Yeah.
Like a peanut.
Like a peanut in the South. Okay, Danica, give us number 4.
Well, number 4 is dear to my heart as a speech-language-hearing sciences major. This semester I am taking phonetics, and we have recently learned of a phenomenon called nasal plosion. And that is the affective co-articulation that occurs when you're saying words like kitten or mitten really fast, and you don't actually say kitten, you just say kitten. So when you go like, that's nasal plosion, everyone.
Wow. I do that every day. Who would have known? So, our third word, getting up there. What is our third word, Danica?
Third word, bronze medalist of the evening, is cruciverbalist.
Cruciverbalist, I like the sound of that.
Yes, well, it is a lover of crosswords, which is very helpful for someone like myself who does the Minnesota Daily Crossword every day of the week.
And perfect for all of you listening, because now you can use these words on the next time you're tackling the New York Times. Okay, getting up there, silver medalist, number 2 is?
For number 2, we have tyrotoxism. Sounds very impressive. It is to be poisoned by cheese, which, could happen quite frequently here in the lovely Midwest, where we are cheeseheads.
Yeah, definitely. And you gotta watch out for those crazy French cheeses where they don't pasteurize their milk.
Yeah, that brie can get pretty crazy.
Of course. And last but not least, number 1...
Drum roll, everyone. The number 1 word, crazy, ridiculous word in the English language is lirapoop.
Lirapoop. What does that mean, Danica?
Well, lirapoop, everyone who goes to the University of Minnesota should know what their lirapoop is. It is the tassel on your mortarboard graduation cap that you switch sides after receiving your diploma.
Well, I sure want to get that at the end of my years here at the U of M.
Yes.
So, all in all, you've got your top 7 ridiculous words. Counting down again, 7, uvula. 6,
brouhaha.
5, gubernatorial.
4, nasal plosion.
3, cruciverbalist.
2, tyrotoxism.
And number 1, lirapoop. So enjoy that and try to put them in everyday conversation, folks. Thanks for listening. And once again, we have Danica Miller and I am Christetta Borini for Culture Q.
The super smash hit film Avatar cost about $300 million to make, and so far has grossed over $2 billion. The film industry is a big business, but it's a little harder for independent filmmakers who don't have the studio support like James Cameron. Miranda Taylor looked at an organization that's giving these little guys a shot at the big screen.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Lights, camera, enter the world of film. The world of Hollywood and Grammys and film festivals, where money, glamour, and fame come together to make what we can only dream of available, so long as we pay the price of an $8 movie ticket, that is. It's not surprising, then, that the first time most people hear about an organization called IFP, a name that originally stood for Independent Feature Project, all the things they think they know about the world of film come to mind. Composition, texture, story, and framing don't usually make the list. Eric Essie, membership and marketing director at IFP Minnesota Center for Media Arts, says that
people have the image of film being this, you know, Hollywood thing that's very profitable.
In fact, most filmmakers never even get close to breaking into Hollywood, let alone ever seeing the profits that accompany a major contract. For the startup filmmaker, another job is almost always a necessity, and an expensive filmmaking school isn't always an option when one cannot expect a monetary return on their investment. Executive director at IFP, Jane Minton, reinforces that filmmaking is not for those who love to live lavishly.
If you want to have a comfortable life with a good income, don't do it. But if you have to make a film, then come to IFP and we'll help you.
IFP lends an outstretched hand to independent filmmakers primarily, but offers resources to photography lovers as well. This support group of sorts offers classes that start around $50 and run up to $350. Equipment rental is offered as well. There are darkrooms, cameras, booms, editing suites equipped with Final Cut Pro, and most importantly, the opportunity to network is available so that one day something as difficult to secure an income in as this can become a full-time job that pays the bills. Founded during the late 1980s, when filmmakers were still editing by physically cutting film with scissors, IFP has come a long way to offer digitized resources and modern equipment. Eric points out,
video isn't just for people who want to become filmmakers these days. Video is in every job, basically. People learning as everyone gets their own iMovie on their computer, etc., that it's not just a matter of using the technology, it's a matter of learning about the art form and collaborating with other people.
It's about understanding the psychological aspects of what an audience wants. To become that next great Francis Ford Coppola or Martin Scorsese, a multitude of skills are necessary. You must excel at screenwriting, production, editing, marketing, distribution, and group leadership. The independent filmmaker must understand how money can even come out of a film. Movie tickets aren't always the only or necessarily best way to fund a film. Sometimes, grants and fellowships can provide much more secure funding. But as we focus on money, it's easy to forget that filmmaking is an art form, right up there with painting and Picasso, fashion design and Karl Lagerfeld, dance and Martha Graham. Eric explains that we need films outside of Hollywood.
So that our culture is reflected back at us, and so we're not just seeing messages and stories about people from far away or from other planets, but we know about our history and our culture and what's going on right here.
Keeping that in mind,
go ahead, make my day.
Check IFP Minnesota Center for Media Arts out at ifpmn.org. Sign up for the e-newsletter or attend an IFP-sponsored art opening or film screening. All classes and events are open to everyone, and membership with the organization is encouraged. Change the fact that the University of Minnesota is underrepresented here. You'll be glad you did. I'm Miranda Taylor, reporting for Culture Q.
I'll go for you, I'll fight, I'll fight, I'll fight, I'll fight for you, I'll kill, I'll kill, I'll kill, I'll kill for you, I will, I will.
This is Culture Q. I'm Ryan Wilson. Here at the University of Minnesota, students are getting ready to register for the fall semester. Choosing the right classes and professors can make or break a college experience. I personally recommend finding the easiest graders. What's the worst class you've ever taken? It's this week's Question of the Week.
The least favorite class I took was developmental bio. Although it's in my major, I have absolutely no interest in it. I much prefer the microbiological aspects of my major. And I didn't like the teacher's teaching style because she always gave us printouts, and I hate printouts. I learn by writing my own notes and not having the teacher give them to me.
My name is Laura. I'm a sophomore at the U of M. The worst class I've ever taken is Bio 1001 because they treat me like I'm in second grade.
My name is Conrad. I'm a junior. My least favorite class would be Spanish because they give you a textbook and a bunch of goofy activities and expect you to learn a language.
Okay, my name is Carrie Heider. I'm a sophomore, and the worst class I ever took was Gen Chem 2 because the teacher was horrible and didn't actually teach us, just had PowerPoints and just rambled on, and basically everyone fell asleep in the class every day.
Felix Schrader, I'm a senior. This is my last semester. The worst class I've ever taken was freshman year geology 1001. I mean, it wasn't a bad class. I mean, I did learn a lot, kind of, sort of. But it was done from like 6 to 9 on a Tuesday night. So it was a night class, and I hate taking night classes. Didn't have a whole lot of time to ask questions because there was like 300, 400 people.
I'm Martha. I'm a sophomore at the U, and my worst class I ever took was stage management. And it's because all the hard work that I did, and no one ever said thank you.
Well, I can't find the way to reach you, my love. I'm just not the same. Just the same to say. But when I know you're watching out for me, I know I don't know.
My mom likes to rip on my generation. She says we just copied everything from her generation. Whatever, Mom, you can have Jimmy Carter. We elected Obama. But maybe my mom has a point. Things like fashion and music do cycle. Zach McCormick looked at a modern Minnesota band that may remind you of a band my mom has in her 45 collection.
Whether it be the recent outpouring of Gaelic pride during our St. Patrick's Day festivities, the giant crowds that St. Paul's Irish Fest attracts yearly, the rich local tradition of Irish pubs, or the tapestry of family lines running through its residents, the Twin Cities has had more in common with the Emerald Isle than may be immediately obvious, and this becomes especially apparent when one examines the musical influences of some of our favorite local bands. Beyond our strong tradition of Celtic folk music from artists like the Chieftains or the Dubliners, a different sort of Irish band has served as an inspiration to a myriad of local musicians. Thin Lizzy has influenced countless artists with a sound that defies easy stereotype. Hard rock seems an ill-fitting moniker for a band that has managed to combine elements of R&B, heavy metal, blues, and Celtic folk into a unique and powerful brand of guitar-centric rock. But then again, Thin Lizzy has always been about defying convention.
Should have took that last bus home, but I asked you for a dance.
Thin Lizzy were founded in December 1969 in Dublin, Ireland, when guitarist Eric Bell met up with organist Eric Rickson in a pub and decided to form a band together. Both Bell and Rickson were former members of the band Them, who had been fronted by a young Jim Van Morrison, and the two decided to go to a show together to check out a local band called Orphanage later that night. Impressed by the talent of the band's singer Phil Lennett and the drummer Brian Downey, the Erics introduced themselves after the show and suggested that the four form a band together, with Lennett on bass and vocals. Eric Bell chose the band's name after a robot character in a popular British comic book series called Tin Lizzy, with the band playing on the Irish accents typical a mission of the age.
Been in by 10. Now I won't get out until Sunday. I'll have to say I stayed with friends. Oh, but it's a habit worth forming if it means to justify the ends. Dancing in the moonlight.
The band released a single with EMI in the summer of 1970, shortly after the departure of Erickson, who left to rejoin his previous band. During the next 2 years, the band would seek to find its voice, releasing two unpopular records that were more folk-oriented and a far cry from their later sound. A successful cover of the traditional Irish song Whiskey in the Jar landed Thin Lizzy a hit single, but Linnett failed to produce a compelling follow-up, and the band faded back into obscurity. After the departure of Eric Bell due to ill health and disillusionment with the band's direction in 1973, Thin Lizzy spent a year in guitarist limbo before settling on 18-year-old Brian Robertson and an American, Scott Gorham. After mishandled production caused yet another record to flop, the band came back with a vengeance on 1975's Fighting. Songs like Suicide and Fighting My Way Back have a newfound aggression, and Linnett's poetic lyrics finally showcase his powerful songwriting ability.
The paper called it suicide. A bullet from a 45. Nobody cared, nobody cried. Don't that make you feel sad?
Finally, after five albums, 1976's Jailbreak took the band to new heights of popular and critical acclaim thanks to its smash hit single, The Boys Are Back in Town, now ubiquitous on classic rock radio. Jailbreak shows the band finally stepping into form, with Linnett perfecting his identity as a street-tough rebel poet, delivering nuanced lyrics and a soulful croon over the intertwining lead guitar sound that the band pioneered.
No one saw the loaf inside the body.
Thin Lizzy would go on to record three more classic albums within the next 3 years before lineup changes and an increasing drug use blunted the band's creative drive. On January 4th, 1986, Phil Linnett died from health problems resulting from his years of hard drug use at the age of 36. Although his life was cut tragically short, Linnett's spirit lives on in the songs of the countless artists he's influenced. Thin Lizzy's emphasis on hard, driving riffs and complex, harmonized lead guitar lines have left a lasting impression on some notable Twin Cities bands. Craig Finn and Tad Kubler of the Hull City, who grew up in the metro area, often cite Thin Lizzy as a big influence on their music. Craig Finn's lyrics work in many of the same themes as Phil Linnett's, as they both share a passion for tales of the glories of rough-and-tumble city life. It's a safe bet that the Hold Steady wouldn't have written Hot Soft Life without Thin Lizzy's Jailbreak. Paul Spangers from Red Wing, Minnesota can also be counted among the Thin Lizzy faithful. Best known as the frontman and songwriter for local favorites Hockey Night before their untimely breakup, Spangers has resurfaced at the head of a new band, Free Energy, which keeps the stadium-sized hooks and guitar pyrotechnics of Thin Lizzy alive.
This is all we got tonight.
This is Zach McCormick for Culture Q.
That brings us to the end of Culture Q. Today you heard stories from Sophia Anasiewski, Sarah Bowden, Christetta Borini, Miranda Taylor, and Zach McCormick. I'm Ryan Wilson. Check us out at RadioK.org and tune in for more reasons why the Twin Cities rock. Next time on Culture Q.
These girls fall.
Support for Culture Q comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.